Chapter 9. Big dog fights. Don't always go to the biggest dogs. What counts is not necessarily the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. I believe it was Mark Twain who actually first wrote those words, although they are also frequently accredited to US President Dwight D. Eisenhower. But no matter who was the original author, it's one of those brilliant little sayings that makes everyone, well, me at least, think, darn, I wish I'd said that. While Ike was probably using it in the context of some military action, it perfectly sums up the mental attitude any entrepreneur or leader of a small startup has to assume when considering what will be needed to mix it up in a space that is dominated by big dogs, aka big brands with big pockets, but often little real loyalty. What's big about small? In the business world, Virgin has always reveled in being the little guy chasing much larger and, as a result, usually cumbersome legacy-laden competitors. From day one at Student Magazine and later at Virgin Records, we were always in the David role and fighting an uphill battle just to survive against a variety of different Goliaths. The irony of the situation that most such young businesses face is that as long as you just kind of muddle along scraping, or for that matter, scrapping out a living, then you are far less of an endangered species than when you start to be a success. As soon as the top guy in the big corner office up the road starts hearing from his sales team that little XYZ outfit that we weren't taking seriously is starting to nibble into our market share, then it's time to watch your backs. Fly me from the gloom. In the history of Virgin, we have run into this phenomenon in just about every new market we've plunged into, but it may have been more marked in our airline businesses than anywhere else. When we set up Virgin Atlantic in 1984 and began flying from London to New York with a single airplane, it was hardly surprising, I suppose, that none of the incumbent airlines saw us as much of a threat to anyone but ourselves. Also, our own people were having such a good time that casual observers might have been excused for thinking that we weren't all that serious about it ourselves. At first, this led to the giants of the day, British Airways, Pan Am, and TWA, all just allowing us to get on with it, assuming we'd implode before we could do them any harm. And, mathematically speaking, even if we'd filled the 400 or so seats on our lone 747 every day, which we often did, it still didn't represent as much as a pinprick in their sacred market share numbers. They were almost right, but they'd totally failed to grasp what we were about, and that we were not into playing by the rules. If anything, we were learning all the time, and very much making them up as we went along. What routinely fools a Goliath is when, instead of going after their market share, someone instead goes out to create a whole new niche market right under their imperious noses. They are well practiced in defending their turf against unimaginative interlopers. This is usually achieved with such no-brainers as deep discounting, leveraging their distribution clout, or what can best be described as simple bully tactics. But when someone arrives on the scene with a hybrid product that they cannot pigeonhole, as was the case with the biblical David's slingshot, it can cause massive confusion in the enemy's ranks. When all else is equal, then the big guys will usually find a way to outmuscle any pesky upstart. So that is why the newcomer has got to make sure that the playing field is anything but level. In fact, You don't even want to step onto their playing field. It confuses them even more when you sprint up and down the sidelines while they get bogged down in the middle. You always know it's working when they cry foul. So in any business where new entrants have traditionally had to buy their way in with deeply discounted fares, what do you do with someone who is suddenly pitching value for money and great customer service? Undercutting an intruder's prices alone doesn't work when price is just one of many weapons in their innovative arsenal. Virgin Atlantic really muddied the equation by arriving on the side of the field with a product that was every bit as good, if not better, than our giant competitor's first-class product, and streets ahead of their distinctly mediocre business classes. The real trick was branding it as upper class, a move that made most flyers assume it to be our first class. In terms of service quality, it was, but by designating it as business class and pricing it accordingly, business flyers, whose corporate travel policies permitted business but not first class, almost saw our upper class as cheating the system, which suited us just fine. We drove the spike in even harder by building in complimentary limos in upper class, a feature that the competition didn't even offer to their first class passengers. For that matter, even Concorde flyers who were paying supersonic fares had to fork out for their own ground transport. It wasn't all about the front of the bus, however. We learned what customers wanted and greatly improved the economy experience as well, with a greater choice of meals, electronic headsets when everyone else still had those awful rubber tube things, and the biggest innovation of all, next to cabin crew who were nice to our passengers, was seat-back TV screens in every seat on the airplane, coach class included. This was something that was not in first class with other airlines. Our big dog competitors thought we were certifiably insane, and maybe we were, and with every added feature became even more convinced we couldn't possibly sustain our presence in the market. What the big airlines failed to recognize was that airline passengers at the time, myself included, were sick of paying through the nose for lackluster service that had been getting worse for years. They were all in that most dangerous of states, where they believed that as long as they are no worse than their competition, then they were doing just fine. All it takes for this status quo of mediocrity to be shaken up is for one little outsider to step into the ring and start punching above their weight. No contract? No problem. We pulled the same trick 15 years after Virgin Atlantic when we created Virgin Mobile to jump into the mobile phone market and duke it out with the likes of British Telecom, BT. Once again, as with the airline, it was my own experiences as a dissatisfied consumer that screamed out to me that we just had to get involved, and quickly. At the time, and to this day, many of the big telecom companies were ripping off their consumers with outrageously high-priced and punitive long-term contracts that stopped just short of you signing away your firstborn. As with our entry into aviation, we really knew next to nothing about the business other than that there had to be a better, more user-friendly and affordable way to provide mobile phone service in a business that was about to take the planet by storm. There were huge parallels to the challenges we'd faced at Virgin Atlantic. There, we didn't own any airplanes or have our own maintenance capabilities or airport counters, so we simply leased everything in or contracted it out and learned along the way. At a glance, the barriers to entry for something like a Virgin Mobile seemed almost more daunting than with the airline. We had no phone masts, exchanges, cables, networks, and all the other super expensive paraphernalia it takes to start a phone company, at least if we were to do it the traditional way, which, of course, we had no intention of doing. At my urging, Gordon McCallum, who had joined us from McKinsey & Company, and team, had been looking into the emerging mobile sector for some time, and finally seemed to have identified what looked like the launch vehicle we needed. We'd become an MVNO, a mobile virtual network operator. After its privatization, British Telecom was obliged by EU regulations to allow other operators to piggyback on their excess network capacity by leasing out time to them. While we'd be competing with them on the one hand, we would also be helping them to earn some substantial incremental revenues to set against their huge sunk costs. At this stage, we met a couple of impressive young BT executives, Tom Alexander and Joe Steele, who not only recognized the MVNO opportunity, but instantly grasped the immensity of what Virgin could bring to the party. At the time, the big legacy phone companies were right up there with airline food as material for stand-up comedians. So we were convinced that a fresh new player like Virgin, particularly with our strong appeal to the youth market and an even stronger customer service ethos, would be a natural for this lackluster sector. We all sensed we were onto something big here, and with my excitement for the opportunity growing daily, I suggested to Tom Alexander that it was time for us to meet and discuss how a Virgin Mobile might function as an MVNO. And what a meeting it was. After a couple of electric hours, it didn't take a lot of arm twisting for Gordon and me to convince Tom to split with BT and come and make it happen for us, bringing mobile phone whiz Joe Steele along with him. So, we had our angle of attack, and we had our senior team in place. Now we needed to decide on a standalone product. Given the hideously complex, impossibly confusing 3-year contracts that were the mainstay of the industry at the time, it wasn't terribly difficult to define the strategy. Small print free, affordable, straightforward, simple contracts, with bills that were super easy to read because, well, there wouldn't be any. With our prepaid format, there would be no end-of-the-month surprises that required subscribers to take out second mortgages to pay their phone bill. We took mobile public in 2004, and after a couple of successful years, were approached by NTL TeleWest in 2006, and we agreed to sell the company in exchange for £123 million and a 10% stake in the enlarged group. A year later, the company was rebranded Virgin Media, becoming the first quadruple play media company in the UK, offering television, internet, mobile phone, and fixed line services. By 2012, Virgin Media had over 4 million customers, and the little dog that was Virgin Mobile took a $6 billion revenue bite out of the previously big dog-only media market. In 2013, the giant US cable group Liberty Global acquired Virgin Media in a deal that meant our investment of around £50 million generated more than £1 billion for us, and we are still involved via a brand licensing agreement with Liberty. All in all, not a bad result for something that had its genesis because I wasn't happy with the level of mobile phone service that was available 15 years earlier. Sometimes, rather than sitting back and complaining about lousy service, it really pays to get out there and find a way to improve upon it by reinventing it yourself. Different think, different do. 20 years after we started Virgin, the critically acclaimed, if grammatically controversial, Think Different campaign from Apple defined the spirit of entrepreneurship like never before. It also encapsulated in just two words exactly what Virgin had been doing for two decades and is still at the core of everything we do today. Thinking differently doesn't necessarily cost any more. It just takes a commitment to not doing more of the same. While no company would ever buy into a marketing campaign of "we are every bit as good as everyone else in our field," that is effectively the way many of the world's biggest corporations have conducted their business for generations. In my experience, this bizarre "stay inside our little comfortable box at all costs" mentality is frequently a byproduct of the malaise that goes by the name of shareholder accountability. When the leaders of a public company's primary focus is their stock price, and with it their performance-linked bonuses, it makes it very difficult for them to take in the big picture. When the going gets tough, the standard big corporation approach is to try and slash and burn their way back to profitability, and with labor generally constituting the greatest single cost, cutting heads and/or pay freezes are invariably the first thing to happen. Now, maybe I'm oversimplifying things, but if one of the primary reasons a company's profits are suffering is poor customer service, then following a round of morale-destroying layoffs by asking the diminished workforce that remains to do more for less strikes me as a somewhat foolish expectation. Rather than digging their way out of a hole, such slash-and-burn tactics will typically only dig it deeper. Smaller companies that have the freedom to turn the traditional corporate pyramid of stockholders first, employees last on its head, and put their employees and customers ahead of shareholder interests are usually doing the latter a far greater service. Learn to look after your staff first, and the rest will follow. Cherish your privacy. I had a fascinating dinner conversation not so long ago with a good friend who confided in me about a problem he's wrestling with, a problem that just about anyone else would die to have. The company he founded a decade ago has been phenomenally successful and dominates a market segment that he pretty much invented. He loves what he does, is still very much hands-on and involved on a day-to-day basis, owns the company outright, has no debt, and has been turning in steadily growing and very healthy profits almost every year for the last decade. So much so that the company has been valued at close to $1 billion. So you might well ask, so what exactly seems to be the problem here? Well, for several years now, his bankers and financial advisors have been pushing him to float the company, but he really isn't sure that it would make sense for him. He could certainly use the funds to speed up his long-term expansion plans, but as he succinctly put it, why sell the farm to force-feed evolution when the business is growing organically at a steady clip? He is, however, being steadily nudged in the direction of an initial public offering, IPO, to, as they put it, unlock the value in his company. Needless to say, the ones who are doing the nudging are his kind-hearted bankers, who would make a very tidy killing from the fees and commissions that an IPO spins off. But I'm sure that has nothing to do with their enthusiasm for the project. In any case, my pal knew that I had been down a very similar road once before and was keen to get my take on his delightful dilemma. I am no banker. Or actually, I suppose I am now with Virgin Money, but it didn't take me very long to come up with my thoughts on the situation. I first asked the question, "By the sound of it, you're still having a great time running your own independent company and have no urgent need for the cash, correct?" He nodded affirmatively. "Well," I said, "there are really no right and wrong answers here, but in my opinion, you have two options. Either you sell the whole thing to the highest bidder and create something new with the proceeds, or you keep doing what you're doing until such time as you don't enjoy it any more, or you just lose the passion you clearly still have. By that stage, the company will have further increased in value, and you also won't be left wishing you'd stuck with it for a few more years, which, knowing you, is probably what's going to happen if you sell it now. His reaction was a deep sigh and a predictable, "Sure, Richard, I'm not saying I want to do it, but if I were to go the IPO route, I'd only sell a minority stake so I'd have the best of both worlds. We'd raise some cash and I'd still be running the company. Right?" My response was a simple, "Wrong. Trust me, I've been there." While on paper you may still be running the company, I can assure you from personal experience that the company you're running and your freedom to run it the way you're accustomed to doing are never going to be the same after you've gone public. Let's face it, countries go to war to protect their freedom and independence. I then took him through a short history of my experiences when we took the Virgin Group public in 1986. Virgin Atlantic was not included in the flotation. I won't take you through all the details, but in essence, the entity that people invested in when they bought Virgin PLC shares at 140 pence was a successful, vibrant company run by a group of fun-loving, slightly batty young people with some wonderfully off-the-wall, aka highly innovative, ideas on how to run a business. The ironic fact was, however, that the moment we became a public company, we could no longer operate in the same way that had made us such a success to that point in time. Everything changed overnight. Our customary laid-back impromptu meetings, where we'd bash around a few crazy ideas and make impromptu decisions, were a thing of the past. They were replaced by hideously formal board meetings, which now had to include outside non-executive directors, who through no fault of their own had no idea as to how we or the business worked. All the results reporting and compliance stuff in general was an enormous distraction from the freedom we'd always enjoyed to focus on the business rather than the books. We suddenly seemed to be spending half our time explaining what we were doing and why to all nature of fund managers, analysts, and other assorted suits. "Screw it, let's do it" became a distant memory. Half the time, our most successful ventures had been based entirely on our contrarian intuition, or carpe diem moments, not on tortuous feasibility studies, business plans, and financial projections. It crossed my mind more than once that if we'd had to explain to one of these people why I thought we should put out an entirely instrumental record, Tubular Bells would never have seen the light of day. And as for Virgin Atlantic, forget it. That one would never have made it onto the drawing board, let alone off the ground. As a public company, it suddenly felt like the Virgin Genie, something that had always thrived as a free spirit, had suddenly been forced into a bottle and was in serious danger of suffocating there. I realized there and then that if working to improve shareholder value was now our raison d'être, as opposed to doing the things we wanted to do in the way that we had to do them, then we could never function successfully as a listed company. I've always seen a business as a group of people trying to improve other people's lives. How do you monetize that in a quarterly report? So, having learned an important lesson, we finally cried uncle, and in 1988 we went out and raised the money to take the company private again. The stock market had crashed, so we could have paid less by going with the diminished value at which our stock was trading, but I was adamant that we'd do the right thing, and every investor got back the 140 pence per share that we'd started out at, so nobody lost money on the deal. Well, at least none of the outside investors. Having listened politely to all this, my friend didn't say much other than, "Oh well, we'll see what happens." I do know, however, that a year after our conversation he still has a private company, is working harder than ever, and, based on a recent phone conversation, his revenues and profits are still on the ascent. A clear case, it would seem, of he who hesitates not being lost. One positive lesson I took away from the whole public company experience, however, was that there are quite a few public company-like disciplines that startups should voluntarily adopt from day one. The reporting requirements of listed companies leave no room for the levels of creative, we'll worry about that later, accounting that a lot of startups practice for years. While the disciplines are mostly on the financial side, better tracking of your forward progress in all kinds of ways gives your people a better metric by which to measure their own contributions and development. And a big secondary benefit will be, if the day ever comes when you do decide to go for an IPO, then the staggering amount of catch-up accounting work will be nowhere near as painful as it was for us. Don't get me wrong, there are lots of occasions when the IPO route makes total sense, and depending on how you have funded your startup, the exit strategy may already have been baked in by your investors. Since our flirtation with operating as a public company in 1986, we have become involved in all nature of joint ventures and licensing deals where we have partnered with listed entities. For all the reasons I've described, however, back then it was not the right way for us to go. There's only one thing that is an absolute certainty in business, and that is that we all make mistakes. And as one should, we learned a lot of valuable lessons from our attempt to go from the rock market to the stock market. Had we given it a while longer, we may have learned to adjust to living in a listed environment. But at the time, I just felt that such a major deviation from the Virgin Way would have required too many compromises. And I had no desire to run a genetically compromised company. So I trusted my instincts and have had absolutely no regrets ever since. Anyone for coffee? In the early 70s, when we were opening our first record store in London, actually a second-floor shop, to be honest, coffee bars were all the rage. Like every cool kid of my generation, I used to hang out for hours over a single espresso, or none at all if I could get away with it, in a little Greek-owned coffee bar right around the corner from our shop. In fact, in some ways, these espresso parlors may have been part of our inspiration for the just-hang-out-and-chill ambiance we dreamt up to help us sell more records. At the exact same time that we were giving coffee away for free to customers sitting on beanbags, three young friends in Seattle were just setting up in business to sell bags of beans. Originally, the three were only going to sell bags of freshly roasted coffee beans, but they soon moved into grinding it and selling it by the cup, which led to the opening of their first coffee house. Looking at the success they have enjoyed with what was to become Starbucks, particularly in light of what happened to the record-selling business, I sometimes wonder if we had it the wrong way around in our first shop. Maybe we should have been selling the coffee and giving the records away for free. While we never did get into selling coffee, Starbucks did eventually overlap into the music business by entering into a partnership with Apple to collaborate on selling music as part of the Coffee House Experience. And in 2006, Apple added a Starbucks entertainment area to the iTunes store, selling music similar to that which is played in Starbucks stores. The rise of Starbucks as an international phenomenon is actually a great example of an IPO working to the greater good, with the funds raised being used to turn a small dog from Seattle into the proverbial 800-pound global gorilla. They may have been able to achieve the same results as a private company with greater control, but it would have taken them a lot longer. At the time of their IPO in 1992, Starbucks was almost 20 years old, but still had only 140 stores, all in the US and Canada, and their annual revenues were around $73 million. The 12% of the company that was sold raised around $25 million, which was immediately used as a springboard to doubling the number of Starbucks coffee shops over the next 2 years, increasing the share price by twofold in the process. By the end of 2012, Starbucks had almost 20,000 stores in 62 countries and over $13 billion in revenues. That's a lot of beans. My favorite, although little known, Starbucks story involves the origin of the company's brand name, which, rather like Virgin, almost started out as something quite different. In our case, the final contenders were Slipped Disc Records and Virgin. I have to admit to having quite liked Slipped Disc, but fortunately for all, it was Virgin that carried the day. I say fortunately because while it would have been an amusing name for a record label, Slipped Disc Airlines, Slipped Disc Health and Fitness Clubs, and Slipped Disc Hotels would probably have presented some rather steep marketing challenges. Anyway, when Starbucks started out in Seattle, the original owners were planning to call it Pequod, after the whaling ship in Herman Melville's classic tale of the great white whale Moby Dick. At the last minute, however, for unspecified reasons, they suddenly changed course in favor of another name from the same novel, that of the Pequod's chief mate, who went by the name of Starbuck. It's strange to imagine the almost 1 million people a day who visit a Starbucks somewhere in the world saying, "Hey, let's get together at Pequod's for a latte. On the other hand, I'm going to grab a Venti Vanilla at Virgin. Want to join me?" Does have a certain ring to it. Little dogs, but sharp teeth. When Ron Faris was the chief marketing officer at Virgin Mobile USA, he once told me how it was a standing joke with the Virgin Mobile marketing team that AT&T would spend more on advertising during one episode of American Idol than we would spend in a whole year. This is, in fact, something that, with the occasional exception, like Virgin Media's ads with sprinter Usain Bolt, has been a long-standing tradition in almost every Virgin company. We have always relied on smart, cutting-edge creativity and scads of often quite self-deprecating humor to get ourselves noticed. It's called getting a much bigger bang for a much smaller buck. The social media revolution has been a game-changer in giving smaller dogs a medium in which they can bark a lot more loudly than they could ever have afforded to do with traditional measured media like TV and print. Even so, the level of creativity involved in tweeting a relevant, engaging product conversation into the hearts, minds, and ultimately wallets of your target audience is still what sets a winning brand apart from the also-rans. And that degree of creativity has got nothing to do with the size of the dog, but is much more about a combination of the sharpness of its teeth and how hungry it is. Creating strong brand affinity, or brand lust, as Ron Faris likes to call it, in today's social media world may be less expensive, but is essentially no different to what we've always done. Learn to cut through the clutter with a message that grabs them by the throat. When, for instance, Virgin Atlantic added shiatsu massages to its onboard upper-class services, much to our delight, British Airways was openly scornful about it. This gave us the perfect reason to put them in their place, with a couple of well-placed billboards around Heathrow Airport sporting a double-edged message that was hard to misinterpret. British Airways doesn't give a shiatsu. Another time, in early 1995, British Airways ran a rather odd two-page spread in all the major US newspapers, including the New York Times, that boasted, "More people choose British Airways to London than any other airline. Duh!" If they'd stopped short of the juvenile duh, we probably wouldn't have thought anything about it. But that strange little word and the tone of voice it projected sent our US marketing team and the creative people at our US agency, CMG Communications, into a frenzy of activity. Within a matter of hours, they'd managed to purchase the same double-page spread in the New York Times and come up with a response ad to ride the coattails BA had so kindly offered up to us. The following morning, New Yorkers opened their papers to read, "More people switch to Virgin Atlantic from British Airways than from any other airline." Ha! Huh. We'd pillaged our marketing piggy bank to run the ad one time only in New York, but the effect was seismic. Clearly refusing to believe that anyone could have come up with such a response in just a couple of hours, British Airways threatened to sue the New York Times, accusing them of leaking their ad. They never did follow through on the threat, but they also never ran their bizarre ad again. Some readers even suggested that we had actually run the first ad as well in order to tee up the second. Our one-off ad placement, however, had an unprecedented tale, as it was written up and quoted in scores of marketing articles and columns for months to come, with headlines such as "Virgin Goes Jugular," almost a precursor to going viral, wouldn't you say? Pink Slip VIPs. As that last story demonstrates, one of the greatest advantages to being the little dog in a big dog pound is the ability to react quickly and ride every competitive coattail that comes your way. Ron Faris and his mobile US team were always masters at this art, and it was never better demonstrated than in 2009, a time when the economy had gone to hell in a proverbial handbasket. With swine flu and job layoffs dominating the news, Virgin Mobile was faced with a tough decision on its annual music festival. Other organizers had already cancelled their events, fearing that fans could ill afford such outings, so the easy thing to do would have been to follow suit. Ron and his team, however, were never very good at being trend followers, and rather than cancelling, they decided to buck the gloom and lighten things up. With a goal of putting out a new energy that would focus on optimism, the upcoming festival in Columbia, Maryland, was given the go-ahead. Not only would it take place, but the tickets would be free, as would a whole lot more. When I got wind of what was happening, I volunteered to join in and greet concertgoers as they entered the park. My brief from Ron was to act like Willy Wonka at the chocolate factory gate. Inside the grounds, we'd created a VIP lounge like no other anyone had ever seen. Rather than being the usual exclusive sanctuary for A-listers, this one was still exclusive, but the only people allowed in were those who could prove they'd been laid off. It wasn't quite a Caligulan orgy, but it came close. Pink slip piñatas were hung from trees, and for a short while, young fans could celebrate a day of free music instead of stressing about getting a job. Happily, times have improved, and we no longer have to pay homage to those pink slips. But Virgin Mobile Freefest was born. And to this day, as the name suggests, the festival is still free. The best part is that our festivals aren't just enjoyed by the attendees. They also raise hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for homeless youth. Doing the right thing and learning to respond quickly to events can also be infectious. That same year, while most of the big car manufacturers were complaining about their free-falling sales, instead of whining, the Hyundai Motor Company came up with its legendary program to buy back cars from anyone who'd lost their job and couldn't afford to keep up the payments. They may be running with the big dogs now, but that kind of pay-it-forward initiative is just one reason Hyundai, together with its subsidiary Kia, has come out of nowhere to be the world's fifth largest automaker, producing over 7 million vehicles in 2012. What makes this an even more remarkable achievement is that they have done it in exactly the same time that I have been in business. Hyundai produced its first car in 1968, the same year that I published the first issue of Student Magazine. More proof that scrappy little dogs can take a huge bite out of the biggest and often the most established businesses. In 2012, Chrysler produced one-third of the number of vehicles that Hyundai Kia turned out. While the likes of Starbucks, Hyundai, and Virgin may no longer qualify as bona fide small dogs, all three of us still live by the same principles that we did when we were just cutting our business teeth. Starbucks is perennially voted as one of the best places to work, and its people are as important to their brand as anything they put in a cup. Hyundai not only builds great cars, but it stands behind them like no other automaker by offering standard warranties of 10 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first, more than double the duration offered by most of their competitors. And Virgin? Well, I think you know how we feel about customer service and people, and although we have been around for 40-odd years now, we're still as scrappy as we ever were, and enjoy nothing better than a good dogfight. So bring it on, big dog. We're ready when you are.